Next Monday is Memorial Day 2014. It's a three-day weekend. For many, the day's a chance to vacation, hit a few sails, maybe even cook out on the grill. If you're a veteran who saw combat or one of their supporters, Memorial Day is another day that you remember those who served in the armed forces and didn't come home. My name is Trevor Harris, and on this week's Thinking Out Loud on KBIA, I visit with veterans, their families, and their supporters about what they'll be doing or thinking about next Monday. One of those veterans supporters is Sedalia resident Donna Fries. She's a retiree who, among other things, helps maintain a local garden club's Blue Star Memorial. You've seen the Blue Star Memorials across the state. They're plaques along the highway that pay tribute to the service of local veterans. Here's Donna Fries talking about the history of the Blue Star Memorials.
It may be of interest to some that Missouri was we had the very first Blue Star marker in the state of Missouri, erected in 1949, that pays tribute to military personnel in past, present, and future conflicts. And we recently dedicated a brand new Blue Star Memorial marker here in Sedalia. It's located at the corner of Broadway and State Fair Boulevard. We did this in conjunction with the local Parks Department. And it invite everyone to come and see it. The significance of the Blue Star on the marker, during World War II, if someone had a family member serving in the military, they would display a Blue Star in their window to let the community know that they had a family member serving. So that is the significance of the Blue Star on the marker.
As I learned when talking with Mid-Missourians for this piece, everyone who commemorates Memorial Day does so for a very personal reason. Like others we'll hear from on the show today, Donna Fries maintains the Blue Star Veterans Memorial in Sedalia because of her personal memories of a military conflict. In her case, it was World War II's impact on her family that motivates her to honor veterans who died in armed conflict.
To me personally, my father served in World War II, was wounded, and subsequently died of his wounds in 1947. He was serving as an MP in occupied Germany. So when I see that memorial, it brings back memories of my father and the service he gave to the country.
Did you know him pretty well?
I did not know him well at all. I only have photos and no memories because he died before I was even 5 years old. So I have no memories of him at all.
How do you think most people relate to the Blue Star? Do people know what it is widely?
Not enough people realize what it is. And I think very few people stop to read what's on the Blue Star and realize that it is a tribute to all military personnel. As I said, past, present, and future conflicts included. So I wish more people would take the time to stop and look at it and reflect what it means.
So maybe it's obvious, but I want to ask the question, what does it mean?
Well, again, it's a tribute to those who served and are serving in our military. And after all, as they say, freedom is not free. And if it weren't for the people serving in the military, we wouldn't have the freedoms that we have to come and go as we please and do work that we enjoy.
Speaking of work, that's something that veterans seek out when they return home. Many seek job training. Others seek out emotional healing through a network of family, friends, and professionals. A longtime writer for the Sedalia Democrat, Letitia Ketting, now works as the Director of Volunteer Services at the Missouri Veterans Home in Warrensburg, Missouri. Ketting has made it her mission to chronicle the story of area veterans. Here, Ketting talks about where her interest in preserving and promoting veterans' stories originally came from.
In 2000, our city editor posed the question to me. He said, Veterans Day is coming up. What should we do? And I said, well, why don't we have World War II veterans submit their stories and a picture of what they look like in the service and what they look like now? He's like, yeah, all right, okay, whatever. Put a blurb in there and we'll see what happens. The response was so overwhelming, we put six stories in that Sunday paper, which happened to be Veterans Day, and then ran a story every single week for the next 3 months.
Oh, my goodness.
So I came up to the publisher and I said, do you think we could have a veterans page? And he's like, well, do you think you can keep it filled? And I said, absolutely. And I did that for 13 years. During that time, save the stories of over 300 veterans all over West Central Missouri, including World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and even younger than that, Desert Storm, and Afghanistan and Iraq. My inspiration came from my grandfather. He was a World War II veteran, and I wasn't smart enough in my younger years to get his story. It was always on the to-do list. I'll get it next time. I'll get it next time. And then you're sitting in a funeral home going, why didn't I do it last time? So it was my chance to save all the other stories of other veterans. And I would have their kids, their grandkids, their wives call, how on earth did you get him to tell you that? He never told me that. I said, all I did is put the tape recorder on. They told me what they wanted me to know. They didn't tell me what they didn't want me to know.
So do you facilitate that story gathering for the veterans and their families at the home in Orangeburg?
Yes, I do. We have a newsletter that comes out every quarter, and documenting those stories is very, very important to me, and I want to do it as much as I can with as many veterans as I can, because again, families get busy, and you're like, oh, I'll get it next time, and you can miss out on that opportunity.
Okay, so for people who aren't blessed enough to get to work with you, mm-hmm. and have you hustling to get the stories, somebody hearing this piece on the radio, what would you say to them about the process of gathering their veterans' stories?
The easiest way, what I find to do, is literally to have a tape recorder. And I have like a small one, so you don't even notice that it's even there. You know, and then, you know, ask about their service. And the way that I usually started is ask them, were you drafted or did you enlist? That's going to set the tone. Because if you enlisted, you knew what you wanted to do. You know, if you're drafted, either you're ticked off about it or you're like, oh, I knew it was coming. You know, and then from there, finding out what they did in the service, what was their job. And then they'll kind of take you, you know, where they want you to go. And you'll know if you stepped on a sore subject, because then they're going to slam the door and move on. So,
asking them the question about enlisted or drafted is one prompt. What are some other prompts that people can use when interviewing and or recording their veteran stories?
Well, so I start off finding, you know, how they got into the service, what they did in the service, and then after they, you know, when they go overseas, well, how did you get overseas? When I was on a ship, did you get sick? Now, some of them didn't get sick, but some of them were so sick, and they will tell you how sick they got. But, you know, it shows that process. I mean, some of them were in typhoons or that kind of stuff. Some of them flew. It was their first time flying. Most of the times, especially with the World War II generation, it was the first time they were out of the state, very well alone, out of the country. So they have reactions to that. So I would kind of follow through with that. And then as I find more of what they did, I ask them, what was their scariest moment in the service? And that usually changes the tone a little bit. And you have, you know, an instant response, or what was the hardest part about your service? Why some people think the scariest and the hardest is going to be the same thing, 9 times out of 10, it's not. It's going to be totally different. The hardest could have been that you were away from home. The scariest is that you were trying to hide from the enemy and you're being bombed all night long. I will always end the interview saying, what does it mean to you to know that you served your country? And then a lot of times you hear dead silence and you see their eyes well up and their responses are just amazing. So that's kind of the process that I go through.
One Missouri group that works to show gratitude to veterans for their service is the Veterans of Foreign Wars and their Ladies Auxiliary. Dolores Wesley is the District 6 Chief of Staff for the VFW Ladies Auxiliary in Sedalia. Here, Wesley shared with me one method the VFW employs to show gratitude to surviving veterans, not just on Memorial Day, but throughout the year.
The best experience I have had in my lifetime with the veterans was I was traveling 2 years ago through Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I always wanted to go to the big National Cemetery for Veterans. And this was a huge one up on a hill, just gorgeous. So my friend and I, we stopped and we were walking around. We happened to see a family gathered, and there was a soldier, airman, that was dressed in his uniform, and I happened to have a commemorative coin from the Ladies Auxiliary. It's our way of saying thank you to veterans that we don't know. So anyhow, I walked up to the gentleman and I told him who I was and I wanted to thank him for his service, and I gave him this coin. And it was his dad that was a World War II vet that was being buried in that cemetery. And he invited us to attend the service. It was moving, just plain moving, to see how it's done and with the reverence that's given.
It was on June the 28th, 1968, that the U.S. Congress passed an act that moved Memorial Day to a specified Monday in order to create a convenient three-day weekend. This shift moved Memorial Day from May the 30th to the last Monday in May. The law took effect in 1971. This Memorial Day, Vietnam-era veteran Jim Gartner will be busy, as he is every Memorial Day. Sedalia resident Gartner is active with numerous veterans organizations. As with Donna Fries, from whom we heard earlier, Memorial Day is for Gartner a personal holiday, a very personal holiday. Gartner served in a pair of duty tours during the Vietnam War. He wasn't drafted, he enlisted because of a family tradition of serving during combat. Here's Sedalia resident Jim Gartner exploring what he thinks about each Memorial Day.
The reason I do these things is because of my background. I joined the Army at 17 during the Vietnam War, and some would say not too bright. I joined the Army, volunteered for the infantry, and then volunteered to go to Vietnam. I served my first tour with the 1st Air Cavalry Division up along the Cambodian border, went into Cambodia during the incursion in 1970. During my first tour, I spent about the first half of my tour walking point. I was a point man, and then later a squad leader. I came back to the States for a while, for about 6 months, and then volunteered for another tour. So I went back and served at that time as a platoon sergeant with the 198th Light Infantry Brigade, and then also served with the 196th Light Infantry Brigade. And the reason for this is I come from a family steeped in military tradition, a proud tradition of wartime service, and so I just wasn't going to be the first one to break that link. While I was in Vietnam, especially after losing friends, I made a promise to those friends that for the rest of my life, I would ensure that they were not forgotten, that they would be remembered, that their names would be spoken often. I believe one of the ancient Greeks once said that a man never dies as long as his name is spoken. So I've made that a mission of mine, and to strive, to endeavor to live a life that would be honoring to the memory and the sacrifice of my friends who didn't come home. So that's why I do the things that I do.
You talked earlier about one of your missions is to speak the names of people who made the ultimate sacrifice. Can you tell me a story about one of the people you served with who didn't come back and something you remember about him or her?
I'll try. When I first got to Vietnam, my first tour of duty, I was at the reception station before I was assigned to my unit, and there was a young man from Millen, Georgia, and his name was Mike Waters. And he was your typical Southern boy. He had that slow Southern drawl. It was almost intoxicating. He had the bluest eyes I'd ever seen. He had wavy, curly, blonde hair, and he had movie star looks. And he was just the most unassuming, humble, Southern gentleman for a young man of his age, and we quickly connected. I remember before we got assigned to our unit, that few days before we were assigned to our unit, they would load us on a truck every day, and they would take us into Saigon because they were tearing down some old buildings. They were going to build an orphanage there. And at some point, Mike had picked up this scruffy looking, like the kind of dog you'd find at the rescue center or at the dog pound. And he had a little piece of twine rope. He made a little leash and a collar. And he hauled that dog around for the couple of days that we went to the pound and just really attached to that dog. And I would tease him about that. And I would go, "What, Mike, what are you doing with this dog? You're not going to be able to take this dog with you when we, you know, get assigned to our units." And he said, "Well, yeah, I know, but," and just had a very charming, boyish quality about him. We didn't know that we were going to be assigned to the same unit, but we were. We were both assigned to Charlie Company, 1st Battalion of the 12th Cavalry Regiment. We were infantrymen. That's what the 1st Air Cavalry was, Air Mobile Infantry. And when we got to our company, we were both assigned to the same platoon, but we were in different squads. I ended up walking point, being a point man, and Mike was an assistant gunner on machine gun crew in one of the other squads. But we remained close. We were good friends. If I thought that anybody was going to survive and go home, it was Mike. Obviously, we all realized that our chances at best were 50-50, not to be wounded or killed in a rifle company. But for some reason, I always thought that Mike would be one of them that would go home. Well, after we had went into Cambodia, we were there for 2 months in 1970. In May and June of 1970, we were there. And we came out of Cambodia June the 30th. And we were happy to be back on Vietnamese soil. The operation in Cambodia had been a great success. We were generally in good spirits. We hadn't gotten mail for some time. So as we set up our night perimeter, we had the mail that they'd been holding for us. And so as we were setting up for the evening there, just before it got dark, we had our fighting positions dug. And we were reading our mail and so forth. And I remember Mike's position was about 20 meters to my left. And I was a squad leader at that point. Mike was still an assistant gunner on a machine gun. And I had just fixed a canteen cup of coffee. And Mike came over to my position. I could see he had a letter in his hand. He was just very excited. And he called me by my nickname and he said, "Hey," he said, I gotta read this to you." His sister was getting married, and originally the date they had set to be married would be while Mike was still in Vietnam. Well, in this letter from his sister, she told him that her and her fiance had decided to postpone the date until he returned home because they wanted him to be the best man at their wedding. So we talked about that, and we talked about cars, the cars we were going to buy when we got home. And being young men of 18, 19 years old, we talked about girls, obviously, and how when we got home, their parents better lock them up because they wouldn't be safe around us, and all those kind of things that young men talk and brag about. And just really looking forward to getting home. So we talked until it began to get dark, and then he went back to my position, and I went and I stayed at my position. In the early morning hours, two mortar rounds landed in our perimeter, and one of them was a ground burst, and one of them was an air burst. We had a rifle company of 86 men, and about 29 men, ultimately, 29 men were wounded with shrapnel wounds. The air mattress that I was sleeping on was blown out from under me. If I'd been sleeping on the ground, instead of the air mattress, it would have been me. I later found out that that was the same round that did hit Mike Waters. But it's the worst night of my life. I still have nightmares about men screaming for medics and for God and for Jesus and for their mommies. All we could do was crawl around in the dark to the sounds of those that were wounded and tend to them as best we could until it got light and we could get some medevacs in. I wasn't aware at this point that Mike had been hit. And as it got light, I glanced over at his position and I saw some medics working on him. I went over there, and Mike had suffered a horrendous head wound. And that's all I'll say about that. But it was non-survivable. It was obviously non-survivable. And shortly after we loaded him onto a medevac helicopter, he died in flight back to the hospital. All the losses are traumatic, and they stay with you. But I think because Mike and I were close in that respect, and especially the conversation we had had just the night before about going home, and he didn't make it. So I do the things I do now to honor him and to keep his memory and his name alive. I've shared this before at different functions and speaking. Every time is just as difficult as the last time, but it's important to keep his name alive and for people to know who he was.
So when Memorial Day comes around, he's who's on your mind, among others.
Absolutely.
As time passes and our elders pass away, we lose those stories that aren't recorded or written down. Family stories fade from memory. The community history gets a little bit less clear. It's those veterans from conflicts earlier than the Vietnam era that we rely on written histories and pictures mostly now to keep their stories alive. One story I found especially relevant to share with listeners this Memorial Day is that of the Exercise Tiger. It was a practice mission in the run-up to the Allies' invasion of Normandy in 1944. Exercise Tiger became a tragic event when, due to a communications error, American ships were unprotected and fired on near Normandy, France in April 1944, resulting in the death of 946 servicemen. That included 8 from Audrain County. Benton City, Missouri resident Lyndall Barker is a nephew of one of those who perished, his uncle, Wallace Wilson Smith, who was 20 at the time. I recently met Barker at his home near Benton City, where he leafed through the yellowing family album that his grandmother put together with clippings that detailed the loss of her son and 7 other area servicemen. Barker talked to me about Exercise Tiger and his Uncle Wallace, an uncle he barely knew but whose memory he keeps alive through community talks around Mexico. He's been to Normandy to see the site of the Exercise Tiger and the D-Day invasion. Here, Barker read from his family scrapbook the names of the 8 sons of Audrain County who died in the botched Exercise Tiger operation.
There were Wallace Smith of Benton City and Garland Buck Donaldson of Centralia and James Walter Sperling of Thompson and Ralph Ernst of Mexico, Harry Mettler of Vandalia, Darrell Ferguson of Mexico, Thomas Creed of Santa Fe, and John Renner of Vandalia.
Benton City resident Lyndall Barker thinks often of his Uncle Wallace and works to keep his memory alive through the community talks that I mentioned earlier. While an official memorial to those who lived in Audrain County and who perished during Exercise Tiger sits on the Audrain County Courthouse Square in Mexico, Missouri, nothing can personalize the memory of a lost soldier like a tenacious family member. Here, Lyndall Barker reads from the last letter his Uncle Wallace mailed home to Benton City, a letter sent back to Missouri almost 70 years ago, and just a couple of days before he died in the Exercise Tiger operation in 1944 when he was age 20.
This was the last letter that my mom received from Uncle Wallace. And it was written April the 19th, but it was postmarked the actual day that he died, on April 28th. It said, "Dear Sis and all, I started to write to you a couple of days ago, but somehow I didn't get to finish it. I wrote to Paul Monday night. I got one letter from you today and 3 from Mom and Clifford. Mom said they had just moved. I guess Norman was glad to be home. He's been in the Navy almost 2 years now, hadn't he? Well, I suppose you went on your trip. I expect you had a good time. Hope Mrs. Weatherford is better now. It is raining like heck tonight, as usual. The evenings are long now. It doesn't get dark until late. I guess I'd better quit. I wanted to write to Mom tonight. I had a nice letter from Brother Bryson last night. I'm feeling fine. Hope you are too. Lots of love, Wallace."
So people didn't forget him while he was there. It sounds like he was happy to be remembered.
Right. And the Paul he wrote to would have been my dad. And then Clifford was Wallace's brother, my other uncle.
That was Benton City, Missouri area resident Lyndall Barker reading the last letter that his uncle, the late Wallace Wilson Smith, sent home from Normandy, France, just days before he died in the Exercise Tiger operation leading up to the D-Day invasion of Normandy in 1944. Memorial Day isn't just a way to remember veterans from decades past. There exists in America now a cohort of post-9/11 era veterans figuring out how to best commemorate their fallen comrades. Before he was elected to the Missouri House of Representatives, Stephen Weber completed a pair of tours in Iraq, ending in 2007. Representative Weber told me recently that for him, there won't be any public celebrations next Monday. Instead, he'll continue to remember his fellow soldiers who didn't come home from the War on Terror.
I know that privately a good number of combat veterans are not particularly enamored with Memorial Day because, you know, there's a lot of us that are dealing with PTSD and dealing with thinking about losing friends all the time anyway, and then to see that turned into a 10% sale somewhere and then broadcast on TV to us when we're trying to think about other things is not always easy for a lot of guys. So I know a lot of guys who have a more difficult time around Memorial Day and don't do anything and are grateful when it's over. And that's probably not what people think or want to hear, but I can tell you that privately there's a good number of combat veterans that feel that way. I don't feel like I need to do anything different to commemorate them on just because somebody picked it out as a calendar day. To me, and to a lot of guys, we're trying to live our lives in a way that commemorate them. And so the fact that somebody put a day on the calendar doesn't change that. I think that for the majority of people, it's the official kickoff of summer. And I certainly have way more friends that go get drunk at the Lake of the Ozarks than go out to a cemetery. When you first come back, that can be difficult because it's Memorial Day. For one, it's Memorial Day, not Veterans Day. So you always get texts, people saying thank you for your service on Memorial Day. And you're like, no, this is about guys that died, not about, there's Veterans Day in the fall. You come back and you sort of want that, or you think about sort of the solemnity of the occasion and memorializing it, and then society goes on with the sales and the partying and kicking off summer. So that can be tough the first couple of years.
That was Missouri House of Representatives member Stephen Weber talking about his reflections on Memorial Day and what he'll be doing this coming Monday. Thanks to him, Sedalia residents Donna Fries, Letitia Ketting, Dolores Wesley, Jim Gartner, and Benton City resident Lyndall Barker for sharing their stories about what Memorial Day means to them. For Darren Helwidge, this is Trevor Harris. Thanks for listening to KBIA's Thinking Out Loud.